From WXXI News, this is Arts Friday on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour will be made 2 weeks from tomorrow in Rochester, Saturday, May 16th. That is the day of the inaugural Black Authors Expo. The idea was born when a local author named Corey Lamar Tanksley found himself talking to other aspiring writers and authors in Rochester. The last Black Author Expo he was aware of was several years ago in Buffalo in our area, but Rochester didn't have anything like it. And so here we are. Tanksley has brought together a group of authors, and his ambitious goal is to turn the Rochester Black Authors Expo into the premier event of its kind in the state outside of the Harlem Book Fair. Will he get there? Let's find out with some of the authors who have joined us in studio for the hour. My guests include the founder and also an author, Corey Lamar Tanksley, organizer of the expo, author of B-Boy to Man. We're going to be talking about your book and your work. Great to have you here.
It is a pleasure. The pleasure is mine, Evan,
well,
truly.
We'll find out about that in about 60 minutes. So maybe you'll change your mind. Cheryl Holland's here. She's the author of Have Your Cake and Eat It Too. Cheryl, nice to see you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Also here is Tracy Williams, author of a book for young men. It's a workbook for young men called The Come Up, and the author of a novel called Urban Development, Adapt or Die. Tracy, thanks for being here.
Wonderful to be here.
And Dante Wirth is the author of Free to Be Me, I Am Not My Issues. Dante, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, Corey, you looked around Rochester and you said there's really no venue for Black authors, nothing like this.
No.
But what's going on in Harlem? There's a book fair.
Yes, I'll actually be a part of the Harlem Book Fair. That's going on July 21st and 22nd. It's probably the biggest book fair, Black book fair in America. Takes up 120, I think it's in the 125th Street. I'm not quite sure the location, but it's definitely in Harlem, and it's huge. And Black authors come there every year, and they sell tons of books. Actually, C-SPAN actually covers it as well.
Okay, and your vision for Rochester is what?
You know, obviously we'll never be as big as Harlem, but we can aspire and we can put in the work. Because there is so little avenues for Black authors, especially here, I said, well, why not? Especially through Facebook. Facebook has been a godsend, mm-hmm. And I just was noticing, so many other Black authors that had books. And not only did they have books, but these books were doing well. And so I reached out and I had an idea. I said, well, what about if we come together and do something historic that's never been done? I'm a student of history, so the fact that we're doing something that has not been done in this area, that's the first, it really gets my engines going.
And so that event, again, it's 2 weeks from tomorrow, Saturday the 16th of May at the Frederick Douglass Resource Center. That's 36 King Street in Rochester at the Douglass Resource Center. All day, the doors open at 10:30, but you're going to have a number of events, seminars for authors. We're going to be getting into some of that as we go throughout the day, even including conversation about the business of writing, which I think is important. I mean, we've talked to plenty of authors on this program, and I'm sure we'll talk to four authors in this studio today who will talk about the challenge of writing, but the challenge of finding an audience. So that's part of it, too. I guess Corey encompasses everything as part of the process, right?
Yes. The business side of it, the creative side of it, the actual stories that we have to tell. The other thing is, there's a perception out there that Black authors are this blob, that we all have the same story that we, that we tell. There's like it's almost nothing different about us, but that's so far from the truth. Just us in this room alone, all four of us have very different stories to tell, very rich stories and deep stories to tell. And a lot of people don't know that because there's a narrative out there of the certain type of story that a Black author may write about. A lot of stereotypes that not necessarily are true.
Well, and just looking at the authors and the books that will be featured at the Rochester Black Authors Expo, it crosses genres. So let me start with Cheryl then. Have Your Cake and Eat It Too.
Yes.
It's very different than a lot of the other books we've seen out there. What's the goal of Have Your Cake and Eat It Too?
It's a self-development book, and I wrote it primarily for women, although I've had men read it and get a lot out of it as well. But it's to help women who have kind of, we go through life and go through issues and we put our dreams on the back burner. And this book is meant to bring those dreams back up front and to empower you to go for what you want.
I certainly understand the notion of women putting their dreams on the back burner. Mm-hmm. It happens sometimes when they become moms, sometimes when women have to look at career opportunities. We've talked about wage gaps, all kinds of different things.
Yes.
Are you looking at everything, the whole landscape? Are you focusing on anything in particular?
The whole landscape. You know, the premise of the book, I use the cake as a metaphor and talking about that we have all the right ingredients to be successful and for everything that we want to do, and just to use those ingredients. So the book is filled with principles on how you can create the life that you want, basically have your cake and eat it too.
Tell me about your own story. Why? What led you to that point that you feel like you want to express this to other women?
Myself, I was married for 14 years, two kids, you know, had the house in the suburbs, the whole, you know, story that everyone thinks is so wonderful. And then it all fell apart one day. And I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't know who I was. I didn't know what I enjoyed. I didn't know what I wanted. So I kind of had to start over and figure out, you know, what is it that you want to have? And can you still do this at this point in your life? And so I went through a process, and that's kind of what I talk about in the book.
And when you talk about those 14 years of marriage, two kids, you said?
Two kids.
Did you find yourself throughout the course of your marriage putting your own dreams on the back burner at any point?
Yes. And at the point of my divorce, my sons were teenagers, so most of my life was spent, you know, going to sports games and following them and what they had to do and taking care of what their needs were. And mine were kind of left, you know, behind. I'd started some things some years before, but kind of put them on the back burner to focus on them.
Now, and my wife and I have a 3-year-old. Mm-hmm. And I look at my brother, who has 12 and 11-year-old. Those boys, unbelievable amount of things to shuttle them to. The athletic stuff can get out of control. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. And he even complains as a dad sometimes that he thinks we should pull it back sometimes and just worry about family time as opposed to always this and that. So it's a complex set of issues. But do you think as a woman, as a mom, can you do what you need to do for your kids to be the best parent you can be without fully sacrificing your own career, your own dreams?
I think you can. When you know how to do it, you know how to organize, you know how to apply the principles and get the systems in place to make that happen. I see plenty of women doing that now.
If you go back in time, what would you do differently?
I would really get clear on what I wanted back then. I wasn't really focusing on what I wanted. I didn't think I could focus on what I wanted personally. So I would really think about what I wanted to do, where I wanted to be in my life at a certain stage, and work toward that, set aside the time to focus on me.
Do we need to change the expectation that the mother always has to sacrifice more than a father?
Yes, and I think the expectation is not necessarily external with others, but the mother herself. You kind of have that impression, whether it's, I think it's unspoken, but most women feel that way, that you have to take care of everyone else first. And I talk a little bit in my book about you have to, you know, like they talk about on the airplane, you know, if there's something that happens and the oxygen masks come down, you gotta give yourself oxygen first, and that's what we don't do. And so we're left, you know, feeling weak and left out and can't breathe because we have no oxygen for ourselves.
That is a tremendous metaphor.
Yes.
I mean, I've never thought about those terms, but I'll say it. I think about my own wife, and I think we've got this great sense of balance, but she is amazing. She's amazing, and she is more than anybody I think I've ever met. She's willing to, maybe her mom too, you know, my mother-in-law. They will always put someone else above them. And I think that's admirable, but sometimes I want her to break away a little bit. And sometimes it's hard to do that, I think.
It is.
You know, if you're not clear on expectations. So without giving away too much of have your cake and eat it too, give me some ideas on what the little steps you can take to start really taking care of yourself while you take care of others.
Well, the first step I always tell people is to really think about what you want. You'll ask a lot of people, you know, what do you want to do, or you want things to be different? What do you actually want, and what does it look like? And until you can figure that out, you can't make a plan to get there. So you have to know where you want, and where you want, what you want, and where you want to go. So that's number one. And the next thing is to really just think about, you know, what skills and talents you have, what gifts you have that you can use to help you get there.
We're going to talk a little bit more about Cheryl's book and about the business of writing and where to find it. But before I even go around the table and hear about the other books, where do people find your book? Obviously, the Black Authors Expo, 2 weeks from tomorrow.
Yes.
Where else, Cheryl?
It's also available on my website, which is assistaproject.com, and then it's available on amazon.com.
All right. Let me bring in Tracy Williams to the discussion. He is the author of a couple of books. But I want to talk first about The Come Up, which is described as a workbook for young men.
Correct.
And tell me about that.
Well, the book, I originally wanted it to be a program, and I was going to the schools and I was talking to young men that had things similar to myself. And I realized once I got older that there were a lot of habits that were taking place that none of the young men, including myself, really wanted to participate in. However, we did it because we wanted to fit into the group. So what I had to do with this particular project is take a curriculum and turn it into a book. As I was teaching the course, my hindsight gave me foresight, if that makes sense. So I had to take myself back to when I was 10, 11, 12 and pay attention to what we were saying to each other as far as our activities. We knew some of the things that we wanted to do weren't right. Your parents would always give you a spanking or something like that to let you know that your behavior was incorrect.
What's an example?
An example. Going someplace and shooting rocks through a window. It was great. We had a great time. But all of us knew we shouldn't be doing it. And if you want to fast forward to young adult, relationally, you know, you'd have a, this is the best example that I can give. You have somebody that you have interest in, and you like a young female, and all your friends would say, hey, you should do this because it's more manly. And so therefore, you're destroying a piece of happiness trying to fit in someplace. And a lot of times I would find that that was the case as I taught this lesson, because I use a Socratic approach when I'm teaching. I don't really teach. I ask them questions and I dialogue with them and I let them answer their own questions. And so I would say to them, does that make sense to you? Another example that I use is if you're hanging with somebody and every day they take $10 out of your pocket, how long would you hang with them? And the answer was 100%, about a day.
Yeah.
So I said, if you want to be successful and you know these are things that you need to do, if you go out and you get in trouble, that's one strike against you, and that's going to be something that's going to be held against you forever. It's going to make you less likely to be successful. That person that asked you to do that just stole from you. And when you use different kind of analogies like that, you begin to see little light bulbs go off in their head. And it's amazing how many of them don't really want to participate in it. So I use this Come Up book.
You say don't want to participate. They don't want to be doing that.
They do not.
But it's sort of a societal expectation or a social expectation?
That is correct. In that particular area, there are no social sanctions that are applied. So the negative behavior continues.
But internally, if they don't want to do it, and then you're working with them on how to stop doing it, how do you get out of that cycle?
You try and do it in groups. You try and reach a large group of people at one time. Because that type of unhappiness and turmoil ends up being mental health issues when you get older. And those are things that people where I'm from, we don't like to talk about mental health or anything like that because it's a sign of weakness. But you have to address those things very, very, very early. I explain how families work, why they work. I use some of my examples of failed relationships, jail. I never did prison time or jail time, but, you know, getting arrested and getting in trouble, going from school to school. All of those things that were a source of unhappiness. And they understand. Believe it or not, this group of young men are a very, very smart group of young men. So over the years, I'm like, I have to put this in a book and try and get it to more people, because that being confined just in the classroom setting where I was teaching at, I don't think was good enough to make a real change. So that's why I wrote The Come Up.
And where were you teaching it?
I started off at Wilson Commencement. Walter Larkins, he was the principal over there, and he had a Saturday school. And I was saying that I wanted to tell my story. He said, well, you can come in and you can start it there. And there were 14 kids in that group, I believe. And out of that 14 groups, and they said it was the worst 14 in the building, 13 of those ended up graduating because we tracked them. And they were eighth graders. And that, you know, 8 weeks, just an amazing turnaround. So,
talking to Tracy Williams, author of a workbook for young men called The Come Up. And we're talking about what it's all about and the way you're trying to reach people. Now, The Come Up, when did you finish it?
I've been doing that now over a decade.
Over a decade now.
Yes.
And how do you find an audience for The Come Up? How do you make sure that you're reaching people?
I originally reached out to schools individually. Mm-hmm. I wasn't trying to sell the book like on a shelf, but I just wanted to go in and say, hey, there's a bundle package and I have a workbook that goes along with it. Fortunately, with Mayor Warren, when Operation transformation came about. Mm-hmm. I did do a public book release, and that was maybe in 2012, I believe. And, you know, she came out and she supported the event. She had me come in and do my course at Operation Transformation. After that, I was in the city rec centers, and I still go into some of the high schools.
You're talking about young men. Again, you're talking about some behavior that you probably needs to change, throwing rocks through windows, you know, hanging out and doing things that are destructive as opposed to things that are fun and harmless or productive, right?
Correct, correct.
The way that young men think about women, the way that young men think about impressing women, all of those things. So you're talking about young men primarily in communities like the ones that you've taught in, city of Rochester, urban settings, yes?
Correct,
okay.
Correct.
So let me, as the white guy in the room who's totally ignorant of this stuff,
okay.
Let me ask a question.
Okay.
Because sometimes people who do not grow up in those communities, they will stereotype, they'll have expectations about, you know, they think they understand, right?
That is correct.
There are certain things I do not understand. And some people think they know where that comes from. Where does that sort of set of social behaviors start to come from? I know there's not any single one answer.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people think, well, if there are more fathers in the picture, but I don't know if that's true.
Mm.
Sometimes it's probably there's a little bit more deep-seated racism, people making expectations about different people or different groups. But what do you think, in your experience, do kids behave that way when they're growing up?
My experience is that I'm going to have to backtrack a little bit before I can answer that question. I was a bad kid, and so I ended up going to live with a white lady. Her name was Mary Piccinino. And so I had the benefit of looking at two different perspectives. I would be with my black family who I was born with, grew up with, I know. And, you know, when I go back and visit, they say, you know, white people this and white people that. And I'm like, nah, that's kind of, you're kind of off. Then I go with my white family and they would say, you know, black people this. I'm like, yeah, you're kind of off.
Right.
But as far as my social setting that I originally grew up in, there was a sense of kids raising themselves. Both parents are working very hard. They're not in the home. So you go out and you hang out and you learn from whoever's popular in that area. And so you begin to do things out of acceptance. And for me, it was pure acceptance. It was out of necessity. And so the thing that I used to hear the most was, if you know better, you do better. You have choices, you have options. And I like to say, it's like a multiple choice test. Answer A, B, C, or D. But you're not aware that there's a choice E. You can only make an informed decision if you have the right information to make a decision based on. So if you got a set of answers there, and you don't know that E exists, and there's a group of people that say, well, we know about E. How do you not know about E? Well, I haven't been exposed to that. I haven't been outside of this environment. That information wasn't readily available to me at that time. So I have to make a decision based on the information that I have. And so that's the hard part that most people don't understand. If you don't have the information, you just can't. You're not making an informed decision.
See, I feel like I want you to talk to every student, white, black, male, female, suburban, urban. Mm. These messages are vitally important.
Right.
And have you seen, you've talked about it a little bit, you've seen some transformation. You've seen some differences made.
Yes, I've seen a ton of differences. And, you know, when you're speaking with them and you ask them questions, like I said, I teach in a Socratic form. I don't really say, hey, this is what you need to be doing.
Right.
I'll say, hey, what's the difference between your school and a suburban school? And they say, well, they do this and they do that. I say, well, are those students better than you? And they take offense to it. Absolutely not. I said, so then why do you think that we have a different failure? That's the way that I teach. And I say, so well, what can you do? If you have a friend and you want them to do better, what advice would you give them? And it's amazing that a group of fifth graders would turn around and give the best advice ever. The best. And I originally wouldn't take fifth graders because I thought they were too young. But now I'm like, okay, let's go to fourth grade and see where this starts at. And it's amazing how much they actually know, but how they perform differently based on environmental expectations.
Remarkable stuff. Talking to Tracy Williams, author of a workbook for young men called The Come Up. Also the author of a novel called Urban Development, Adapt or Die. Why did you decide to write a novel?
There was an older group of people that I couldn't teach to come up to. So I said, how can I get some information out? and change their mind. So my thing is I wanted to create a new villain, a smarter villain. And with the urban development, what I use is dialogue between the characters to address societal opinions. So I got, you know, a white character, I got a black character, and they would dialogue and they would talk about things that are happening. And hopefully that the same message that I'm doing in the come up would also help an older group, because I'm using a more of a New Jack City type thing. But it's not similar to New Jack City at all. It's a book about a young man going through a certain problems, and he sees that corporate America is just as dangerous as the streets in America. So he goes through an eye-opening experiences, and he has some white friends in there. They end up being senators and whatnot. And so they dialogue. And so through dialogue of the characters as in an art form, we as authors have an opportunity to do whatever we want to when we're penning our books. And so we can create a reality, and that reality oftentimes becomes an escape for the reader, and they live vicariously through those characters. So I wanted to create a new villain that was smart and that would kind of be able to win at the same time going against the status quo.
Wow. Tracy, before I turn the conversation over to Dante's work, you mentioned you described yourself as a bad kid growing up.
Yes.
How did you turn around? You're not a bad guy now. How did you turn around?
I'm going to have to say my mother, my birth mother. She was a wonderful, wonderful mother. Like I said, she worked very hard. My father worked very hard. I found myself, you know, hanging out in the streets, being a member of a gang, doing things that I knew full well I shouldn't be doing. And then, you know, I got lucky. I got a couple of mentors. I was able to get out of the city, see things from different perspectives. And once I started feeling a little more comfortable about myself, then I was able to say, well, I don't need to perform this way. And those type of things. So it was more like an eye-opening experience where I'm like, we're being taught some things that's inaccurate.
Yeah.
And if we don't address those things starting very early, then these things turn into problems as adults, because some of my problems follow me into adulthood. My friends have followed me through my entire life, and sometimes it's just like, okay, we need to stop the cycle, and this is how we do it. And we as authors have a wonderful ability to reach a vast amount of people. And writing in an art form itself is attractive. And so we can use the same type of media that was used to come up with a different image of us to say this image is very inaccurate. You look at Cheryl, you look at Corey, you look at Dante and a group of other people that are going to be there. We use our art as a way to combat stereotypes and also get a message out there.
It's great stuff. It's really, really great stuff. And the big takeaway that I think everyone should make sure that we really hear loud and clear from Tracy is that if we're judging kids, well, some of them are kids, some are young adults, sometimes kids, who get into some trouble, you're hearing Tracy say, so many of them know it's wrong, don't even really internally want to be doing it, but feel like they've got to conform, and once they understand there are other paths, so many will take it.
They will. They 100% will.
What can we do? Can we mentor? Does mentoring help? Do those kind of things make a difference?
Mentoring does help. I had four great mentors, and I speak about them in the come up. But also, just your regular, everyday, average person can begin to have the difficult conversations. Sometimes they're very difficult to have. Some white people feel like they can't talk about our environment. Some black people feel like they need to bite their tongue in certain environments. But the difficult conversations need to happen in order for us to move forward. And until we address them and address them accurately, we're going to keep having problems. Like I said, I had the benefit of growing up in two separate households, a white family and a black family. So it gave me a totally different perspective, totally different. And I realized that both sides have some things that they need to work on.
Tracy Williams, where do people find the Come Up and Urban Development Adapt or Die?
They both are on Lulu.com and Amazon. And create space.
Okay. We're going to get a break in, and when we come back, we're going to talk to Dante Worth, the author of Free to Be Me, I Am Not My Issues. And Corey Lamar Tanksley is the man who put this big expo together. He's also an author himself. We're going to talk about his work. If you're just joining us, Rochester's inaugural Black Authors Expo is 2 weeks from tomorrow. That's Saturday, May 16th at the Frederick Douglass Resource Center. That's on King Street in Rochester if you want to attend. And there's also, if you just go to Facebook and search Black Authors Expo, you'll find they got the whole event rundown there. So different seminars, things that are going on there. You can see the whole menu of events there. So short break and more with these authors next. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Dante Wirth is sitting directly to my left, and he is the author of a book called Free to Be Me, I Am Not My Issues, which is a book, Dante, about what?
It's about my journey, my truth of coming from turning my wounds into wisdom, really. All the different struggles, all the different issues I dealt with growing up and how I overcame those issues.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up right here in the city of Rochester. I grew up with my mother and father in the city. The different challenges I faced growing up, some in school, some in the home, just a lot of different things I had to go through.
Okay. And is there a core message you want people to take away from your book?
My biggest message that I want people to take away is that just because you have some issues in life, because no matter what walk of life you come from, no matter how old you are, life doesn't discriminate when it's giving out challenges. We all have some issues. A lot of us are dealing with self-esteem issues, insecurity issues, issues that no one else really knows about. And I want people to know just because you have issues that you are not your issues, that just because you've made some mistakes in your life that you're not a mistake.
Dante, for our listeners, unfortunately can't see him. He's a really good-looking guy, and he's sitting next to me. He is. He's got a great sense of fashion. I was saying I love the threads on his book cover. He's just a good-looking guy. It did not occur to me until reading more about the work that you have done in this book that you were diagnosed with alopecia at age 8.
I was.
Honestly, I'm just looking at him going, to me, bald is beautiful because I'm about to be bald, I'm months away probably. You're just a really good-looking guy. But alopecia is not something I know much about. And you were 8 years old?
8 years old when it first happened.
Was that hard?
It was because it was why I woke up. Actually, when it first started was when I was 8, but it regrew. I don't really remember when it happened when I was 8, but it regrew, and it started coming back out when I was 14.
So you're 14 years old, and for our audience that don't know what alopecia is, what is alopecia?
Alopecia is a autoimmune disease that makes your hair come out. Basically, the hair follicles choke because the immune system is moving too fast, and it chokes the hair follicles, causing the hair to fall out.
Okay, so all your hair falls out, and it happens when you're 14, and I'm sure your peers are really cool about that, right? Because kids are really nice about stuff.
It's actually one morning I was getting ready to go take an exam, and I was in the bathroom picking out my little afro, and next thing I knew, every time I picked the hair, another patch of hair came out, and I just started to panic. I was like, oh my God, I don't know what's going on. So for the next couple of weeks, I just started wearing hats, and for the next couple of years, I started wearing coverings. I wouldn't even live out the house without something on my head because I was just so afraid of what people would say, how they would treat me, and because of how I saw myself. So dealt with a lot of insecurity issues because of it.
I'm sure even with a hat on, some of your peers probably took a little liberty with you.
Yeah, especially when I grew up in a time where everybody wanted to wear the hats and stuff were stylish, so they were wondering why I was allowed to wear my hat. So they wanted to make sure, like, they just wanted to know why they couldn't do it. So whenever you could have a privilege over someone, they're usually either jealous of it, so they want to figure out why or whatever their reason was. A lot of struggle.
And that's when you're 14, 15. What are you, 23 now?
23.
Are you more comfortable in your own skin now?
Way more comfortable. Way, way more comfortable. Like you said, hashtag bald is beautiful.
It is, though. Well, maybe not for everybody. For a lot of people. I mean, probably not for me eventually. But it looks good on you.
Appreciate that.
But do you remember how old were you when you really felt that I don't need to wear a hat? I'm good.
It actually wasn't until I actually graduated from high school in 2009. I decided to shave off all my hair. I still had a little hair left, and I decided to shave it all off. And after that, I was like, wow. That's me in the mirror. I could see me. I didn't have to see the hair. I didn't have to see what people saw. I just saw me.
Well, let me interrupt Dante, because I want to get back to his book in a second, but let me grab a phone call. And this is in Honeyoye Falls. This is Wiley. Wiley, go ahead.
Hey there. I was just listening to the show, and it's something that I've been thinking about for quite a while. I got a thing going in my house. I'm trying to get a business going. And I decided that the neighborhood kids would be good for the kind of stuff that I got going here. I'm talking about 10, 12 years old. And I'm not trying to get cheap labor. I'm just trying to, I mean, that too, I suppose. But just get the kid. I can't get these kids interested because all they want to do is sit around and watch TV and play video games and, you know, they got their nose glued to their cell phones. And I'm thinking, there's got to be something I could do to motivate some kids or get them out. And I'm thinking, here's all these kids, and one of you guys said something about, you know, I just didn't know another way. And I'm thinking I got away, but to be perfectly honest, the way a lot of people are, I'm afraid to get kids I don't know into my house, and then you don't know where I am, and then some of the bad kids are, well, what's he got around here, you know, can we take it? And that sort of thing, and it makes people afraid to get involved in that sort of thing. But I would kind of like to. And, you know, is there some kind of avenue for somebody like me to talk to somebody and, you know, open up some doors for some kids?
Wiley, it's a good question. And the person you heard talking earlier about helping especially young men and boys was Tracy Williams, the author of a workbook for young men called The Come Up. Tracy, first of all, what do you think?
I believe it's very possible to pull off what you want to do. I would first suggest that you ask them what they want to do and have them work their way backwards from where they want to get to, and you know, explore them that way, and make them talk to you, and make them become accountable in front of their peers. And so you can start picking the ones that give you the answers that you want to hear and grow from there. And eventually, once you have a program that's working, other kids are going to want to be a part of that.
Well, now, here I am, fat, stupid, and happy in Honey, I Falls, and there isn't a whole lot of that around here. But I can't get the fat, stupid, happy kids in the neighborhood interested. I mean, how do you, aside from me going into the city, which is difficult for me because I have a visual impairment now and I can't drive very well, but I'm working at home and I'm trying to get my own business going here. But on the other hand, I could probably make time for a kid, maybe one, maybe two, but probably just one. But he'd have to get here, and, you know, how would you suggest I go about that?
Well, Wiley, thanks for the call. Tracy, let me kind of sum up that part of what I'm hearing from Wiley, which is that no matter our backgrounds, 10, 11, 12-year-olds, of which you've spoken so extensively, they are attracted to what the groups are doing. You know, it's hard to maybe pull away from bad habits for
Correct.
Kids. Whether it's crime, whether it's not, you know, respecting adults, whether it's not respecting young girls, whether it's being lazy. So I think in general he's asking the question, and someone like you, I think you're very well equipped to at least address it. How do you start to kind of peel kids away, you know, and make them think about doing more productive things?
I'm going to have to steal something that I read in a marketing book when I originally started writing. The people from Twitter said, identify the one in the group that's the most popular, make him successful, and they'll follow him.
That's a good answer.
Just like,
that's a really good answer.
If you have somebody that has, like, you know, 5,000 followers on Facebook, it's a good idea to tag him in one of your posts because it's going to hit their page. So I would take the one that's the most popular, try and make him the most successful, and use him as your blueprint.
It's a really good answer. And Paul in Brighton wanted to call in with a comment or a question. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I heard earlier someone commented that there was a limited number of venues for African-American authors to publish their works. And you know, I'm wondering, there's about, I don't know exactly, 50 to 70 million African-Americans in the U.S., and there's certainly a lot of non-African-Americans who are interested in those works. Maybe not as many as there should be, but there's certainly a good number. And the publishers, there's only one thing that motivates them, you know, it's just money, right, profit. So certainly there ought to be publishers who want to publish these works. And I'm wondering why there isn't more of it being available.
Well, there is, if you go to Walmart today, there's a section that's, you know, has black literature, but it's, in my opinion, it's a lot of it is very stereotypical. It's not very intelligent. The subject matter is very limited. So there are plenty of publishers who will publish that same story over and over and over again. And there is an audience for that. But a lot of times, you know, we have to create our own. For instance, my business partner and I, we created our own publishing company to put out my book. So a lot of times you have to be creative and you have to figure out a way to do it on your own. And we like the fact that we did it on our own as well because we own it. And there's a sense of pride when you own a story rather than asking somebody to sell your story. You can sell it yourself.
And Paul, I think I gravitate to the point you made, which is that the non-black possible audience should grow. We need to go outside of our own experience sometimes and not assume, as Corey says, that a section of literature is going to be monolithic and it's all probably just confirming stereotypes we already have, mm-hmm. which again, maybe that sells, mm-hmm. but that doesn't really help. And so I'll give you a follow-up if you want, but I think that was a very good point that you make.
Yeah, it's just that, you know, there's a lot of smaller subjects. Like, you go to a typical bookstore, there's always a few sections that have, you know, someone might be interested in the history of, I don't know, Antarctic anthropology, or some obscure subject like that, and yet there's going to be a good number of books on that because somebody thought it was profitable enough to pursue it. And I would think that with even given a small percentage of a large number is still a large number. So a small percentage of non-African Americans who are interested in this still would result in a pretty significant number of books that want to be published.
It should
respond to that need.
It should. Yeah, I think it's a good point, Paul. But that's partially why I think, at least I'm getting from Corey, that's partially why you're organizing efforts like this, right?
Right. So that, you know, again, the book fair is free and open to the public, and we want everybody there. We don't care if you're purple with polka dots. Mm-hmm. We want you there because, again, it expands, and somebody who doesn't necessarily know, or they may have a certain fascination with the African-American culture or books or material or anything of that nature, then they'll be able to go and get, you know, my book or Dante's book or any of the other authors that we're going to have there.
All right. Well, it's 2 weeks from tomorrow. It's May 16th. You know, Corey's right. We can get outside of our own sort of sphere of whatever normal literature you read and you read on a regular basis and try something new and meet people. And the great thing about it, I think anybody who reads, it's always great to meet the authors and to experience who they are. And, you know, people like Dante. Again, Dante's book, Free to Be Me, I Am Not My Issues. Before I turn it over to Corey to talk about his book, because this hour is evaporating pretty quickly.
It's going fast.
It is. It is. Who's your target audience? Who do you want to read this, Dante?
My target audience is anyone who's been through anything, really. Anyone who's really struggling silently. A lot of people have a lot of silent frustration built up because they're dealing with things. They're wearing a smile. They're looking happy. But a lot of people who are the most miserable wear the biggest smiles. Mm. And I really want to target those people who really are dealing with those struggles in private and hopefully help them to come out and just be themselves and not just be themselves, but become themselves.
It's such an important message, especially to people who I think about you as a 14, 15-year-old. Don't you wish your 23-year-old self could say, it's all right. You're going to be okay.
Right.
But, you know, when you're in middle and high school, you think the world's ending every little thing.
Everything.
Every little thing. The book's called Free to Be Me. Where do people find it?
You can find it either on Amazon, also at Dante with a D-A-N-T-E. A lot of people spell it D-O. D-A-N-T-E, worth.com. You can find me on all social networks, also at Dante J. Worth.
Dante J. Worth on social networks, DanteWorth.com. Corey Lamar Tanksley.
Yes,
put together this expo, but you're also the author of a book called B-Boy to Men. What's it about?
The book, it's about growth, and it's about respect and how important respect is and how important it is to cherish relationships because the basic thing of the story is sometimes the right person can come along at the wrong time, and then there's after effects of that. The book takes place first of all, it takes place in 1989, and it takes place at a college. We have three main characters. A young woman, it's set right here in Rochester. She's from Greece, 18, very intelligent. Young man, he's a bit aimless, but he's very intelligent. He's a bit of a lady killer. He's still kind of searching for himself without really knowing that he's searching for himself. And then there's a professor that they all meet at the college. The professor actually was a prisoner who went from prisoner to having his PhD and able to teach at this fictional college called McNair College, and is actually based on Brockport State University, where I graduated from. And we watch what happens when they all connect. And I wanted the book to take place at a college campus versus, you know, a stereotypical place where a lot of these the books that I was talking about earlier tend to take place. You know, it's always about a drug dealer or always about some sort of side chick or just, you know, there are all these horrible stereotypes that I did not want to perpetuate. I wanted to show that, you know, these characters are intelligent. They're, you know, they have something to say, but they're flawed as well. They're human. They're three-dimensional. They're not two-dimensional like a lot of the other characters in some of these books are.
And where can people get it?
People can get it. Amazon.com is 4.8 rated stars so far. yes, it's, trust me, it's a very good book. Amazon.com, B-Boy the Man, and you can go to any local bookstore, order it, and it'll come to you. Or I'll even deliver it to you for myself.
Talking to four authors who will all be there 2 weeks from tomorrow for Rochester's inaugural Black Authors Expo, Corey Lamar Tanksley, Dante Wirth, Cheryl Holland, and Tracy Williams, and there are four of how many who are going to be there?
They're going to be, we just added literally the last one a couple days ago, so there'll be 12 of us. There'll be a dozen authors. We'll be signing autographs, taking pictures. Again, there'll be panels. And we have a nice mix of, again, Dante is 23, mm-hmm. and I think the oldest author, I think he's in his 60s. You know, we have females, males. So, again, you have a wide spectrum mm-hmm. Of the African-American diaspora.
And the doors open at 10:30. Mm-hmm. 2 weeks from tomorrow at Frederick Douglass Resource Center. That's on King Street in Rochester. You'll find the full list of events as the day breaks down from 10:30 to 5. You'll find it on Facebook if you just search Rochester Black Authors Expo. Mm-hmm. Cheryl Holland, you're going to be involved in an author panel talking about the business of writing. Mm-hmm. And the business of writing is something I think anybody who's wanted to write a book about anything, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, then you have to grapple with getting it done, getting it published, finding a way to make sure people see it. What will you be talking about in the panel?
One of the things that I'm going to talk about is building a platform, knowing who your audience is, and building a following based on that audience, even before you start writing your book. Because what happens a lot of times is you have the idea for the book, you get it written, and you get it published, and now who are you going to sell it to? So if you start working on that in advance, know who your audience is, who you're trying to reach, start building the platform with that audience, and then you'll have a following who will be anticipating your book.
Sometimes I think just in my read of conversations with authors on this program and elsewhere is that there's so much hard work that goes into just writing a book, and understandably so. But sometimes you think, well, I wrote a book, now it'll sell itself. It's just snap your fingers and everyone will know it's there and everyone will go get it.
No, being an author is a business. And you have to approach it like a business. And that means especially if you're going to self-publish. If you're going to self-publish, that means you have to do everything yourself. And that includes marketing the book and, building the platform. So you have to treat it like a business. It's not just writing the book.
Cheryl Holland is the author of Have Your Cake and Eat It Too. And how did you start to find an audience for your book?
Well, because I'm an empowerment speaker and a business coach. So I had a platform. And so I was doing that first, and then I wanted to add the book as mm-hmm. another opportunity to reach that audience.
Okay. And for you, just sort of a natural extension of what you're doing then, in
yes.
many ways, it seems.
That, yes.
To me,
that. Mm-hmm.
But what's the hardest part about the business of writing?
For me, it was actually setting this time aside to get it done, to do the writing. Mm-hmm. I did it in two ways. I wrote some, and then I had some audios that I had transcribed. So even for those people who, you know, have a story to tell but don't necessarily like or know how to write, you can also record yourself and have someone transcribe it for you. So that's what I did.
It's hard, isn't it?
It's hard work.
Writing a book is hard. It's really hard. It's a lot of fun for the first day or week, and then and then you go, what have I gotten myself into? Corey, what's the most daunting or difficult part for you?
We'll put it like this. For me, it's the hardest, easiest thing I've ever done, ever. My best friend, who helped me edit the book, again, we were self-published, so we did everything ourselves. He convinced me that I could write a book. I used to rap back in the days and stuff, and I never thought I even had the ability to write a book. When he approached me with the idea, I said, I can't do that. He said, no, you can do it. And sometimes it takes someone else to see in you what you don't see in you and to bring it out of you. And that's what he did. And going, it's just being able to set aside that time, because, again, like Cheryl said, it's the business of it. When you own your own everything, you have to do everything yourself. You can't pay somebody else to go and put flyers up for you and do all that. You have to do it yourself. So I'm actually working on the second book. This is my book is a series of four books, and I'm actually working on the second book now. And, you know, when you're doing 100 other things, you still have to set aside 2-3 hours to do the actual writing. And it's hard. It's hard.
Do you, as much as you need support and people who will help you, do you need people who will occasionally say, this isn't really working, or I would work on, do you need that?
Let me give you an example. Before the book was finished, because my characters, the characters I have to write in a female voice. So
wow.
I would, yeah, you have to write in a female voice.
Yeah, yeah.
So what I would do is my I would say, okay, well, I know a few people from, you know, because of the social network across the country. So I would send about, I took about 6 females, and I said, okay, listen, I'm going to send you something, and I need you to be as honest with me as humanly possible on what you think about it. So when I sent it to them, some of them would come back and they would say, well, who helped you write it? I'm like, well, what do you mean? Who helped you write the female part? I said, nobody helped me write the female part. I wrote it. And that let me know right there that it was authentic. They believed it. They thought a female actually wrote that part. So a lot of times you have to put yourself out there and you have to be willing to be critiqued. That was the hardest thing. You have to be able to be critiqued and take that.
Dante, got to be willing to be critiqued. How do you feel about that?
I agree. You totally have to be willing to accept what people say about your book, because when you write it, you think it's the best thing since sliced bread.
You have to have a thick skin, don't you?
You really do, because people, you may think you have the best chapter. You may have think you have everything lined up, and they're like, that's wrong, that's wrong. Why did you even put that in there? Take that out of here. And then your feelings is hurt. Now you got to bounce back and get back to writing.
And Tracy, as someone who's written both nonfiction and fiction, how do you feel about that?
The hardest part for me was removing the bias and getting to know the characters intimately. So there was a little bit of research that I had to do. Like I said, I talked to my white family and I talked to my black family. I talked to my white friends and my black friends, and I would say, hey, does this sound right? How do you feel about this? So the hardest part for me was getting to know my characters. Like, some people will look at me like, you're talking about them like you know them. I said, I do. So that you really got to get into it.
I've talked to some authors who, when a character in a novel dies, my friend who is an author, she said when a character in her book dies and she writes it, she cries and she needs like a day. She just needs a day.
I can relate. Sometimes when I need to kill off a character, my pen won't move. I'm like, I'm going to miss him very badly.
Well, we hope you can come out and meet Tracy, Dante, Corey, Cheryl, and another 8 authors, a dozen authors, at the inaugural Black Authors Expo in Rochester. That's 2 weeks from tomorrow, Saturday, May 16th, at the Frederick Douglass Resource Center on King Street, 10:30 to 5, a number of different expos, books for sale there, a chance to talk to them. And I opened the hour wondering what the city thinks about this. Corey, you've put this together, and I was surprised to hear. I don't mean to cast aspersion on the city administration, but it's such an interesting idea, and doesn't sound like there's been a whole lot of help from the city.
No, we put everything. I call us the collective. The collective put everything else. We put everything together ourselves. We did reach out to the city, but because we were a for-profit, they did not feel they could help us. So, you know, we understand it. It is what it is. So now, you know, we're trying to make it so successful, you know, so that next year, when we track the numbers, when we track the people to come, you know, maybe they would want to be a part of it again. So hopefully they will be a part of it next year. They'll find a way to figure out whatever. But, you know, we would love the city, you know, and everybody to be a part of it. I think this is a great idea. I think the authors are unbelievable. You know, I've really gotten to know all of them pretty good. And, you know, it's an idea that time has come. The time has come for it. It really has.
Easiest place to find the schedule online, I've been mentioning Facebook. Yes. Is that the best way to go? So yep. Facebook, search for Rochester Black Authors Expo there.
Yep, and it has a lot of stuff. Oh, and let me mention real quick. Yeah. We're having a youth writing contest also. We're going to give away some trophies and stuff. So if you are in the 7th through 12th grade and you're in high school, no matter what color you are, no matter what type of school district you go to, we have 3 different types of essays. Who am I? bio and poetry, send it to me, corey.tank00@gmail.com. Send it to us, because we're going to give away awards for the best youth author. We all feel the need to give back, just like Tracy was saying. We all feel the need to give back, you know, to the community. And they need to know that black authors, male, female, exist, and we're doing good things in the community.
Well, you certainly are. Congratulations to all of you. Corey Tanksley.
Thank you.
Cheryl Holland, the author of Have Your Cake and Eat It Too. Corey's book is B-Boy to Men.
Mm-hmm.
Tracy Williams, the author of a workbook for young men called The Come Up, and the author of a novel called Urban Development, Adapt or Die. Tracy, thanks for coming into this program and sharing your story. Really remarkable stuff. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And Dante Worth, author of Free to Be Me, I Am Not My Issues. Best dressed man at the table, too. It's good to see
Thank
you.
You're good
Thank
to see
you.
Me, too.
And once again, 2 weeks from tomorrow for the Expo. Come back next year. Tell me how it went. We'll do it again. We'll do it again.
Pleasure.
Have a wonderful weekend. John Andrus, great job as our engineer today. I'm Evan Dawson, and this is Member Supported Public Radio.